This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
The Congolese public, who are very, very against any form of a negotiation with M23, because they feel this is a Rwanda-backed rebel group that's illegally taken over Congolese territory.
That's David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, on the DRC President Felix Tshisekedi's rejection of direct dialogue with the M23 rebels. Details coming up also. U.S. tariffs may rattle Nigeria's auto market. And the future of the ceasefire between Israel and U.S.-designated terror group Hamas is in doubt. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, has rejected calls for direct dialogue with the M23 rebels. His statement followed a joint East Africa Community and the Southern Africa Development Community meeting that called for a ceasefire and dialogue to resolve the conflict in the Eastern DRC. The call named three former leaders of African nations, Nigeria's Olusegun Obasanjo, Ethiopia's Hailemariam Desalegn, and Uhuru Kenyatta from Kenya, to mediate in the crisis. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, explained the reasons behind the rejection to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think Tshisekedi is facing pressure from two fronts, and this is why he's rejected any effort to get to the negotiating table with the M23 rebels. On one hand, he's facing a lot of domestic pressure in Kinshasa from the Congolese public, who are very, very against any form of a negotiation with M23, because they feel this is a Rwanda-backed rebel group that's illegally taken over Congolese territory. But I think the other element of this, sitting on the table with the M23, will give legitimacy, recognition to M23. And this is against what Tshisekedi feels is within the protocols of the Nairobi peace process, whereby they feel all of the rebel groups, including M23, should be at the negotiating table. And then in relation to the other element of your question, the three heads of state, I would not be very enthusiastic about that initiative. The reason being, there are three or former presidents, leaders from three different countries, each country having its own separate interests, and also coordinating these three former presidents who also have their own personal busy schedules, I don't think will be very, very helpful or effective, particularly in light of the fact that we're dealing with two different peace processes. So I think it would be a lot more helpful to have a professional diplomat, a single person who's a diplomat, not a politician, to try and work behind the scenes to bring Kigali and Kinshasa closer together, meaning President Kagame and President Tshisekedi.
The Ugandan army confirmed Sunday it has sent troops to another town in northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo to fight local armed groups. The deployment was requested by the Congolese army following alleged massacre of civilians carried out by a militia known as the Cooperative for the Development of Congo. Analysts fear that Uganda and Rwanda's growing presence in eastern DRC could lead to a repeat of the so-called Second Congo War, which lasted from 1998 to 2003. Is that a legitimate fear?
I think it's a legitimate fear, but for different reasons. So the Second Congo War was really an effort by President Kagame to unseat President Kabila, because Rwandese military advisors were being excluded from the Congolese army. But it failed as a second invasion of the DRC, because Uganda had its own separate interests and did not want to support Rwanda in overthrowing Kabila, unlike the First Congo War, which was a united effort by both Uganda and Rwanda to remove President Mobutu. So my concern here would be that both countries might intervene very aggressively in terms of the intervention in the DRC, but for different reasons, whereby you might find Uganda intervening to support the Kinshasa administration and Rwanda intervening to try and remove the administration. And this might also bring in other external actors into the conflict. And here I'm specifically thinking about the Angolans, whose army is very battle-hardened, having fought many years against UNITA, into the conflict very much like they did during the Second Congo War. So I'm very concerned for an escalating conflict, very similar to the Second Congo War, but for very different reasons in 2025 than that there was during the Second Congo War in the 2012-2013 period.
That was David Manda, professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawy. Rwanda said today it was shameful of Canada to impose sanctions over its involvement in the conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. The M23 armed group, backed by thousands of Rwandan soldiers, according to UN experts, has captured large areas of the Eastern DRC in recent weeks, provoking international condemnation. On Monday, Canadian Foreign Minister Melanie Joly condemned the presence of the Rwanda Defense Force in the DRC and its support for the M23. Canada said it would suspend export permits for controlled goods and technologies to Rwanda and review its participation in international events hosted by Kigali. Tonight, President Donald Trump will address a joint session of Congress at the U.S. Capitol building just a few hundred meters from our VOA headquarters here in Washington. This speech will be his first to Congress since he returned to the White House in January. Over the past few decades, presidential speeches to Congress have tended to focus on domestic issues, not foreign policy. Earlier today, my colleague Peter Cloutier spoke with Ni Akuet, a former professor of international affairs at George Washington University here in Washington, about his expectations for the speech.
Yes, normally I wouldn't expect a lot of mention of Africa. I don't think that if you go back, and it's not just this president, if you go back to previous, even the one president who is the son of an African man, I mean Obama, I don't recall him even mentioning Africa. Maybe he did, but point is, the U.S. Society and their politics, they don't rate Africa very high. Africa is the lowest of their on their totem pole. So my normal expectation, we'll be lucky if the word even comes up once. I doubt that it will come up, but I stress normal because we are not in normal times. So the second abnormality is that actually since Trump came to power in the 6 weeks, 5.5 weeks, he has bombed the terrorists in Somalia.
But do you see the president making, you know, reference to the fact that perhaps America will take the fight to them, irrespective of where they are, particularly even in Africa, like what he did in terms of Somalia's terrorists?
No, I don't see him doing that at all, because he in particular, you know, on the one hand, he says, projecting strength. But if you consider the last four presidents, all the way back to George Bush, 40-41, Trump is the one who says, no, I don't want to go to war. Okay, I'll do anything not to go to war. And actually the sentiment, U.S. public sentiment, in my opinion, supports that. I mean, all across the political spectrum, you've got mainstream media, right-wing media, all of them saying forever wars. So remember, remember that the Biden pulled out of Afghanistan. But the plan for pulling out of Afghanistan was signed by Trump. But all of them have read the American people say, if you send troops anywhere, you are in big trouble. Okay, so, and Trump, I'm saying in particular, in part, doesn't want to send troops anywhere. But he's dropping the bombs in Somalia. This is my point. It surprised me because in his first term, the only thing he did with Africa was pull troops out of Libya when there was a fight to support the government of Libya against, you know, some of the insurgents. And U.S. troops were protecting the Tripoli. And he pulled them out. And then just before he left office, he also pulled them out of Somalia. You're asking about my expectations. So, no, I'll be very surprised if he does that. The only other Africa thing is I'm also surprised that he imposed sanctions on Rwanda and M23. But those were two individuals.
That was Nia Kuet, a retired professor of international affairs at George Washington University. He was speaking by phone with Peter Cloete, host of VOA's Nightline Africa program. Tune in our special Daybreak Africa radio program tonight when it will be covering the president's speech to Congress. It begins at 0130 UTC, that's 8:30 p.m. Washington time. Join hosts James Buddy and Carol Van Dam for all the details of the speech, which begins at 0200 UTC, 9 p.m. Washington time. The United States plans to impose a 25% tariff on imported vehicles starting in April 2025. While the policy targets cars entering the U.S., the decision could impact Nigeria's auto market, which is dependent on American used car exports. Many fear the new tariff could drive up car prices, but others wonder if it could make U.S.-made cars more affordable for Nigerian buyers. Gibson Emeka has the story from Abuja.
For longtime automotive importer David Tope, Nigeria's auto market has become increasingly difficult. He used to import up to 5 vehicles per week from the U.S. and Canada. But since 2023, import costs have surged dramatically, driven by currency depreciation and increased duties. By early 2025, Tope paused his import business.
It's not just the country that's the thing, but our inflation rate is so high on duties and on the naira devaluation, so it's affecting importing from any country at all. It's not just for the car to be cheap, but also for our custom duties to be reconsidered so that the normal man can at least survive this business of car dealership.
While Tope mulls his next move, the U.S. announced an impending 25% tariff on vehicle imports. This raises concerns for Nigeria's used auto market, which is dependent on used U.S. imports.
So U.S. is the main market of importation that we do. So if inflation rate of 25% is being put on their cars, it's going to affect Nigerian market. So, but if the car are being produced in U.S., it's going to be cheaper for us. But if the cars are being imported to U.S., then exported to us, the inflation rate will be unbearable for car dealers like me.
Importers aren't the only ones affected. Vehicle prices in Nigeria have jumped nearly 400% over the past 2 years, putting car ownership out of reach for many consumers. Nigerians like Emmanuel Aaron and Akintunde Akinmolaye worry the U.S. tariff will exacerbate price woes.
Honestly speaking, the cost has gone so high that my interest in buying cars has to be postponed.
Yes, we know that U.S. cars are built with quality, care, and comfort compared to other places. But in terms of cost now, cost may make one jettison all those preferences.
Economist Awa Mustafa believes a 25% U.S. tariff hike could reshape Nigeria's auto market. If the U.S. prioritizes local vehicle production, fewer used cars may be available for export, pushing up prices in Nigeria. Beyond affordability, she says the import business itself is at risk. Thousands of Nigerians depend on vehicle imports for their livelihoods, from importers to mechanics, parts dealers, and transport workers. Currently, Nigeria produces about 14,000 vehicles annually, a fraction of demand. Experts say strengthening local manufacturing is the only long-term solution.
The more that needs to be done is to help to revive, is to seriously, you know, purposefully and intentionally work towards strengthening our steel industry, work towards strengthening our supportive infrastructure that will enable more production of some of these already locally assembled vehicles.
For now, Nigerian importers like Tope are in wait-and-see mode. One thing is clear, the U.S. policy could reshape Nigeria's auto industry in ways yet to be seen. For Gibson Emeka, Steve Miller, VOA News.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. The trial of several prominent Tunisian opposition figures accused of national security offenses opened today, with rights groups denouncing the case as politically motivated. The 40 or so high-profile defendants include former diplomats, politicians, lawyers, and media figures, some of whom have been vocal critics of President Kais Saied. A report with the French news agency AFP reported that those already in detention were not allowed to attend the trial in person and followed it remotely. Charges in the case include plotting against the state security and belonging to a terrorist group, which could entail hefty sentences and even capital punishment. Lawyers for the accused told the AFP that there is no evidence that justifies a plot against state security. The University of Illinois Soybean Innovation Center is creating a new market for soybeans in Africa to compete with palm oil and help U.S. farmers grow their market for exporting one of the biggest commodities from the U.S. But funding for the Innovation Center is provided through USAID, and that funding is now stopped. VOA's Ken Farbo visits the Soybean Innovation Center and has this report.
As friends and family members gathered for Friday prayers outside the Will County Courthouse, jurors inside deliberated less than 90 minutes in a murder trial that shook the Illinois Muslim American community. 73-year-old Joseph Suba was found guilty on all charges, including murder and hate crimes, for fatally stabbing 6-year-old Palestinian American Wadi Al-Fayoumi and wounding his mother, Hanan Shaheen.
I don't know if I should be pleased or upset, if I should be crying or laughing.
The young victim's father, Odai Al-Fayoumi, spoke to reporters after the verdict.
I'm the father of a child, I've lost a child, and I feel like this decision came too little, too late.
No verdict is going to bring their son back.
Amina Barhoumi is with the nonprofit Muslim Civic Coalition, which helped draft the Wadi resolution that passed in the U.S. Senate in September. The measure recognizes Wadi's death as a hate crime for his Palestinian Muslim identity. The murder took place 1 week after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack in Israel that killed more than 1,200 people. Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror group, also took hundreds of others hostage. The Wadi resolution affirms that the United States has zero tolerance for hate crimes, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Palestinian, and anti-Arab discrimination. Again, Amina Barhoumi.
It's a moment to grieve Wadia, but it's a moment to also ask, what are we doing to ensure that Wadia is the last?
That is what Joseph Juba yelled as he stabbed at them. Muslims must die.
Ahmed Rahab, who led the Friday prayers outside the courthouse and translated for Odai Al-Fayoumi, is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Chicago office.
This is one of the worst hate crimes that have been committed in recent memory that targeted an innocent six-year-old boy, a kindergartner, and his mother. The boy was stabbed 26 times, as you've heard repeatedly. You can imagine the brutality of the scene. It was very difficult for the parents to have to live through the details, the gruesome details, so our heart goes out to them.
Illinois has one of the country's largest Muslim American populations. The largest concentration of Palestinians live in Cook County, especially the Chicago neighborhood of Bridgeview, also known as Little Palestine. Again, Ahmed Rahab.
All of us who are parents, who are Arab, who are Palestinian, I happen to be Egyptian American, who are Muslim, we all saw our children die in Wadi Al-Fayoumi. Because this could have been any one of our boys.
Rahab says plans are underway to construct a permanent memorial to Wadi at a children's park in his hometown, the Chicago suburb of Plainfield. Joseph Zuba's sentencing is scheduled for May 2nd. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Joliet, Illinois.
The future of the ceasefire between Israel and U.S.-designated terror group Hamas is in doubt. Linda Granstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's announcement that it is blocking humanitarian aid from entering Gaza through its checkpoints has caused fear and panic buying in Gaza's markets. The move comes as the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins, when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk and share festive meals in the evenings. This year's Ramadan is taking place amid massive destruction caused by 16 months of heavy fighting between Israel and the terrorist-designated Hamas. Mai El-Khodri is a former school principal who was displaced from her home in Gaza.
The closure of the crossing has a negative impact on us, as displaced people will have returned to Gaza City. It's the month of Ramadan, and we are in need of many things. My house was bombed and destroyed. I have nothing, and there is nothing in Gaza. Everything is expensive and not available.
Israel says there should still be enough food in Gaza to last for months. The humanitarian aid cutoff comes as negotiations on the second stage of the ceasefire hostage release deal between Israel and Hamas have faltered. Hamas seized 250 hostages in an October 7, 2023 terror attack on southern Israel, sparking a war that has left tens of thousands of Palestinians and more than 1,700 Israelis dead. So far, 147 hostages have been returned to Israel alive, most in two ceasefire deals with Hamas. Israel has also released some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the move to cut aid is intended to force Hamas into continuing the current ceasefire deal, as proposed by U.S. President Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff.
Israel has decided to stop letting goods and supplies into Gaza, something we've done for the past 42 days. We've done that because Hamas steals the supplies and prevents the people of Gaza from getting them. It uses these supplies to finance its terror machine, which is aimed directly at Israel and our civilians.
Many Israelis have voiced support for the prime minister's hardline policy, but many of the families of the remaining 63 hostages are afraid that the suspension of aid to Gaza may cause more suffering for the hostages and even jeopardize their release after more than 500 days in captivity. Zahiro Shachar Moore is the nephew of an Israeli hostage killed in Hamas captivity.
Holding the humanitarian aid trucks from entering Gaza is also affecting our hostages. We know for a fact that the hunger in Gaza affects them directly. And we know from the people that came back and gave testimonials, our hostages are getting harsher treatment.
Hamas, Arab states, the United Nations, and human rights groups have condemned the Israeli blockage of aid shipments, accusing Israel of violating the ceasefire terms. The Arab League will hold an emergency summit this week to address the need for an end to the war between Israel and Hamas. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.